Hello, everyone. This is Mike Rohde for the Sketchnote Army podcast. Before we get started in this episode of the podcast, I wanted to mention we've got a new clothing line we're releasing that gives you an opportunity to support Sketchnote Army, the website, the newsletter, and the Sketchnote Army podcast. If you go to sketchnotearmy.com/t-shirts, you'll see this variety of t-shirts that we have to offer. It's men's and women's cut t-shirts in 5 different colors, as well as a heavy-duty hoodie in 5 different colors. So you've got quite a variety to choose from. All the purchases that you make of these t-shirts and sweatshirts will support Sketchnote Army, the newsletter, the website, and of course this podcast, and help pay for all the costs that it takes to put these out for you. So if you'd like to go there and check it out, this is a way to support the Sketchnote Army. It's a way to make a statement about your being a sketchnoter, and these can make great gifts as well for those in your life that you know do sketchnoting and would like to have something that would be kind of cool and different that will get people to notice. So go check it out and support the Sketchnote Army at sketchnotearmy.com/t-shirts. And now, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to the Sketchnote Army podcast. I'm Mike Rohde, your host, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, and I am super duper duper excited to welcome my friend Evalotta Lamb to the show. Hello, Evalotta, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Evalotta, where are you calling us? Where are we talking to you from today?
I am in Berlin in Germany.
Ah, sehr gut. Sehr gut. I've been to Berlin, but not for quite a while, back in the 90s. So as I understand, Berlin has pretty much radically changed. If I showed up there now, having been there in the 90s, I probably wouldn't recognize anything but the oldest items, you know, the different places. So that's an exciting place.
It has definitely changed since the 90s.
Yes. But,
and it's still changing.
That's one of the cities that I'd really love to go to, mainly because both you and I are designers as well. So I'd love to see the design things that are happening there. And it was quite inspiring when I was there at the time. So it would be fun to go back. So I'm working on that. I'm finagling some things to maybe come over and visit. So maybe we can go have a coffee in Berlin one of these days. But now, what we want to do is give people a little context. So many people will know who you are and you're quite influential. I know so many people have mentioned you and how inspirational you've been to their sketchnoting and the way they think about things. And so I think maybe it makes sense to start with you giving us a sense of like what you do and who you are, and then how you sort of came into sketchnoting.
All right. What a vast question, who I am. I haven't even answered that for myself yet. But I am, you could say professionally, I'm a designer. I've been doing a lot of web and interaction design for more than a decade, I'd say. I'm freelance at the moment, and I'm mainly working on sketching and sketchnoting and teaching people how to sketch like in two strands, how to sketch in their design process. So that's basically for other designers and user experience professionals who design websites or applications, and how they can use sketching in their process. That's a little bit more technical, I'd say. And then I also teach sketching in the wider sense for helping your thinking, your communication, for doing sketch notes, and for doing everything that is basically linked to visual thinking.
Hmm. Well, that's wonderful. And so I think, as I remember, I think you've worked for, am I correct in saying you worked for Skype for a time and Google for a time?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, okay. I thought user experience design there.
Yeah, yeah. So so that's quite cool. And maybe you haven't identified what your story, how you stumbled into this sketchnoting thing. I'm really curious to hear that story myself.
All right. Well, I've always been drawing. Like I just like pens and paper. And I would say when I look back at my notes from school and at my notes from university, they all kind of quite visual, so they contain the text and the stuff that you were supposed to write down, but also little diagrams and sketches and kind of decorated headers and things like that. So I think it was kind of a normal form for me to put on paper not only the words but also some visual stuff. But formally, I'd say I discovered the term sketchnoting probably pretty early on, after you put a blog post out there or something with your sketchnotes from South by Southwest. And I was like, oh, look, this looks an awful lot like what I'm doing when I'm listening to people explain stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, he calls it sketchnotes, so that's an interesting term. Maybe that's what that is called or could be called. And I've been since then, when I went to conferences and talks, I kind of tagged my sketch notes, which I knew what they were now, with this term when I put them on Flickr. And over time, I think I paid more attention to the form, because it was interesting to observe how I could, what I could do with it, let's put it like that, like how I could play with the balance between text and image, how I can push the images more, how I could use both text and images to structure the page. And I think, yeah, by looking at it more from a meta level, it, the form itself kind of developed more, because I took an interest in the form itself, mm-hmm. not only the notes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That sounds almost the same thing that I discovered in playing with it, you know, just sort of as I realized it was, this could be a thing, then you start thinking of it as a thing. Like I look back in my history and in college, I was doing this same kind of thing you said, where I would take notes and it just seemed natural to, you know, assign images, or there would be images that would appear in my head and I would just capture them. That just seemed the most natural thing ever. And it didn't have a name then, you know, and when I stumbled onto this name, it seemed to fit. And when I, you know, your experience of having, you know, seeing me post something and saying, oh, that's what that's called, I continually hear that, where I've been doing this for many years, but I never knew what to call it. So it's interesting how having a name for something can provide sort of a little bit more focus. Even that simple thing can give you sort of a little more direction and make it into a thing that it wasn't before. So that's pretty interesting that you're
well, labeling in general is super powerful. I mean, working with visuals as well, like labels, for me, labels are as important as the visual is. So yeah. It's not about like drawing stuff and making people guess what you're drawing. It is about combining the power of language and the power of images. And they are really good friends, you know, they mm-hmm. like to shake hands, and sometimes the two even like to hug, you know, they are buddies and they shouldn't be separated. They should have fun together. Let's put it like that.
I completely agree. And I know, so some people may not know either, if you're new to this whole space, Eva Lotta's got several books of her own, and what she's done over the years is capture the sketch notes that she took at conferences and then bound them into books by year. I have several of these. I believe the most recent one that I don't have yet, which I need to order, is I believe you've done a book of your travels. So you took a sabbatical and have traveled the world a bit, and I believe that those, I think you've produced those as a book. I know they're on Flickr, but I'm not sure is the book available now?
No, there is no book yet, okay. But there might be a book in the future.
Okay, that must be why I don't own it, because it doesn't exist yet. But we'll in the show notes, I'll make links to all of Eva Lotta's work, and of course the work of her travels. And it's interesting, one of the things I observed about the travel sketch notes in particular, and I quite love doing them myself, and they're a little bit different. There's a different dynamic than it is in a conference in many ways, but it's was interesting to see what they look like when you began your trip to where they were like when you got nearer to the end of the trip, how they, even in that time frame that your experience and the way they shaped themselves over time changed a little bit. That was really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about maybe what that experience is like to travel and sketchnote it and maybe observe how things have changed or how maybe they stayed the same in other senses?
Yeah, just to give context. So in September 2014, my boyfriend and I started on a 14-month backpacking trip around the world, which led us through 15 countries, I think, in 14 months.
Wow.
And we've been back since December last year. Yeah, beginning of December last year. So, we wanted to take time off work and just have a great time together and just see the world and stuff. So, and I had a few ideas about like little projects that I might do on the way because I wanted to also keep making stuff while we were traveling, but I wasn't sure what it was going to be. But the basic idea, one of my basic ideas was, well, I want to have a diary and I probably want to have some kind of a visual diary. Mm-hmm. Like it should include visuals, I guess, because I just can't help myself drawing. Like I'm not a big writer. So what I did is I created a little template for myself. I was thinking, oh, how do I want to structure it? Also because I don't like, I'm not very much for linear stories. So I was thinking, well, I'm going to make myself a little template with one spread per day. Mm-hmm. That had like a little header that said, I am here. So for the place and what date it was. And then I made up little categories that could guide me towards collecting, like, I don't know, moments during mm-hmm. the day. So I had, the first one was something I had to drink or eat today, because trying out new food and new drinks in crazy locations is one of the, well, it's one of the great things about traveling. It's mm-hmm. kind of eating weird food.
Yeah.
Then I had somebody I saw or talked to today, because you see weird and wonderful people in the world and you meet them and you talk to them. Mm-hmm. And then I had something that made me smile today, like maybe small things, and it was something I learned or noticed today. So the newness, talking about the newness. Then I had an idea or a thought I had today. So more like introspecting or reactions for me to what I'm experiencing. And then I had, then I had the best thing that happened today, which very, very quickly in my notes, I erased stuff of it out and it just became other things that happened today, because I figured out it is absolutely impossible to pick one thing to be the best of the day. And it turned into this catch-all of other things that hadn't fit in any of the other categories that I wanted to capture. And then the last thing I had was a fact about me, because I also wanted to see how this traveling, you know, like a little introspection to who am I as a person and what can I say about me, and how does the traveling kind of remind me of things to say about myself, maybe, or I don't know. I just thought a little introspection or something random about myself as a person could be interesting as well, and see what happens with that. I don't know. So I made this spread where I just had these prompts littered over the two pages, and I got I got little books printed on very cheap paper, just like print on demand books that were empty except for these prompts on each spread. So I took those and I started using these books. And in the beginning, there was definitely more text than there were images. Mm-hmm. And because I don't know. I mean, I do a lot of sketchnoting, but every time I sketch, it's like even within a day, you know, you have to groove yourself in. And you need, it's like with everything that needs, that is a physical activity, it needs practice and it needs warming up. So the first half hour that I sketch, is the sketches are not as good as in the second, and the second half hour is not as good as in the third half hour. And like, it's just like that. You groove yourself in, like an athlete warms up, you know, and you don't start to sprint in the Olympics. You don't do the first sprint of the day in competition. You warm up a bit. The same is true for sketching. And you can also say that over longer periods of time. So I had to groove myself in to doing these sketch notes on the trip. You know, it's like in the beginning, there's much more text, and the images are smaller. And it took me some time to kind of figure out how to, you know, how to arrange the stuff and how to play with the space, you know. And sometimes when I didn't have something for one category, I just crossed out the prompt and other things took more space, or sometimes I changed the prompts, or, you know, like I didn't let it turn into a corset that I thought like, oh, I'm obliged to find something today that, I don't know, an idea that I had today if I had no ideas. And I was just, I don't know, absorbing the stuff around me. Then I got rid of that and changed it to something else. So, yeah. So I spent about, I would say in overall between an hour and a half, 2 hours a day to kind of fill this spread. So I got a lot of, just technically and manually, I just got a lot of practice on this trip because it was a very regular activity. So I was actually pleased to see that my sketching, just skill-wise, actually improved as well, because, yeah, I was practicing each day for at least an hour and a half. Wow. It does make a difference.
Yeah, it certainly does. And, you know, there's, so when I hear you explaining sort of the structure and the approach that you took, a couple things came to mind. One was, I really love the way that you created these prompts. So the temptation would be to go off on this trip and have a blank book. And now you're staring at a blank book and you're in this beautiful place and you have no idea like where to start. So before you began, you sort of set out these possible things to write about. And then I love that you modify those. So if you came along and said, well, there's nothing, it was no good food I had today, like you could just stroke it out and talk about something else, like the beautiful colors you saw or whatever, right? It gave you enough structure that you didn't have to scrounge around to figure out what you were thinking, but yet it gave you also the freedom to not necessarily follow it if you chose not to. That was really interesting.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought was interesting is that those books might actually be a really interesting product. I don't know if you've thought about that, but it could be really interesting for you to create some kind of a prompting travel sketchbook that others could take along. And you know, based on going away for so long, you probably could even, you know, open the book with, here's my experience, here's some suggestions, now start on this page and go, right? And you just have a page after page of these structured prompts, or maybe you mix them up or something. That, for some reason, that popped in my head too, that it could be a print on demand, a demand type of booklet that people could buy, and, you know, that they could maybe follow your path in that sense as well.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that as well. It's like a few of my own projects that I want to do. It's on the list of things that I think would be cool to do.
Yeah.
In some shape or form. Actually, since I returned, I've not taken on a proper job. Like, I'm my own boss.
Good for you.
And that kind of, I'm working on my own stuff, and I'm mainly working on my own stuff and teaching at the moment. And I think that's going to carry on like that for a while. So at the moment, I'm not looking for a new user experience design position. So I'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's very inspiring. I mean, I would love to do teaching and such full time right now with a family and so on. It's not the ideal situation, but I'm working toward it. Their opportunities are opening. And I mean, the challenge, probably you might even agree with this, is I still kind of love just design, like the UX design process, and working with people is quite fascinating. And what I'm finding is ways that I can actually sneak this sketchnoting or sketching or visual thinking mindset into my daily work, which is actually a fun challenge. So I'm in no way, you know, unhappy with the situation. But of course, you know, long term, it would be fun to focus on that. And I have to say, I really admire you for stepping away. You know, you're definitely doing great work, and you're working at great companies. And for someone to step away and say, I'm going to take many months off from my career in user experience design to go and travel the world and experience it and document it in this way could be really scary. I mean, I'm sure there were probably scary moments heading into
You know what happens? Nobody notices that you're gone. Really. And you're not missing that much, really. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Like two or three new phones came out in the time. And like, I don't know, but really you don't miss that much. Seriously, and nobody notices you're gone. They're all like, "Oh, what? You were gone?" I think it has less of a negative impact. I don't think it has any negative impact on on your career. I don't know. I mean, I can only speak of myself, but I do think that the fear is probably greater than the negative impact in reality is, definitely. Right. Well, you gain so much in experience and you gain so much in an open horizon and in new thoughts that, I don't know, especially as a designer, this is priceless.
Yeah, it almost seems like necessary, right? It's important that you change your perspective from time to time, however that, you know, whatever that looks like for you. And, you know, many people will, you know, they're thinking in the future like, oh, when I'm, you know, 65, then I'll take this time and go travel the world. Well, what if your legs don't work well anymore? Or, you know, like you don't know what the future might be like. I really am inspired that you were willing to break off in the middle of things and go do this. I know Stefan Sagmeister talks a lot about these sabbatical years that he would take. So I don't know if that was any kind of inspiration, but he found that they were quite, they actually made his work better by doing that, by taking a break. I think it was once every 7 years, he would go off to Indonesia or something and spend a year doing his own stuff, which it sounds, you know, very similar to maybe what you're doing and how valuable that can be in the right situations. So I really admire you for that. And I think that's a really fantastic example that you give us, that we don't have to feel, you know, trapped or that we have to do things in a certain way, that we've got lots more flexibility than maybe we imagine.
Yeah, that's always a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. No, if anybody is kind of dabbling with the idea of maybe doing something like that, I think it's always a good thing to not do something because you're afraid of it. I mean, fear should not be the reason not to do something.
Yeah.
It is easier said than done, but it's kind of one of my basic rules that I set out for myself a long time ago when I was studying. And I'm scared of many things, believe me. And what I usually do is I start telling people that I'm going to do that when I'm still in this phase of doubt and I'm a little bit scared. And then if I have said it to a few people, then I can't back out because I already said I would do it. And then it's just like, yeah, go. And in the moments that the fear kicks in, you just trust your former self that it made the right decision and you just go on.
Yeah, I agree. I think so. If I look back at all the times when I was afraid of anything that seemed fearful at the time, I just forged forward and I actually found it very rewarding. And I think maybe you would agree in some sense that the more you do it, the less the fear has a hold over you. Like you can say, well, you know, I did these five other things when I was afraid and it turned out okay, so maybe I'll just push a little farther and do this next thing that I'm afraid of, because it probably will turn out okay. And even if it maybe it doesn't turn out exactly right, you know, the other four times it worked out pretty good. So it's only 1 of 4, 1 of 5, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's a mental game.
Like most of the decisions that I'm talking about, I mean, it's not about, you know, should I don't know, go and visit a war zone or something. You know, I'm not seeking danger. I mean, most of the situations that we're talking about, the decisions are, like, they're not life or death decisions, you know, they're just, They're most of them or all of them are kind of reversible. you know, maybe with a little detour. But I mean, mm-hmm. I was also thinking, you know, what happens if I had enough after 2 months, you know, and I want to have my own bed again, and I want to be home, and I hate it. And guess what? You know, I can always come home. You know, I have enough money in the bank account to buy me a flight from anywhere in the world home. Sure. I might have, you know, I have to find a new flat and I have to find a new job, and that might mean some effort and it's not ideal, but it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, that's a good way to approach it too, is find these structures that support your decision, that you know you've got these other options. And I think that's it. Sort of what we are getting to in general is this idea that you have many more options than you often allow yourself to believe you have. And to think of it that way is a really powerful thing, especially once you start, you know, doing things that you think were impossible before, and you find out, well, they're maybe not as possible as I thought before I got into it. So good for you. I'm so proud of you and so inspired by you doing this. And it inspires me to think of creative ways that I can do that. You know, I have a family, but one of the things that we've tried to do every spring is we take the kids on a spring break somewhere. So my kids have traveled lots, more than I did when I was a kid. So we feel like that's a good skill for them to have, this comfort in being a little bit uncomfortable and doing things differently and trying new things. So it's not always easy. It's a challenge many times, but we find that it's making our kids look at the world in a different way. And I think that's really important.
Good for them.
You know, I think, you know, after this discussion of travel, maybe we switch to another topic, but it's really fascinating because way, way back, I actually met some Germans here in Milwaukee who were visiting, the first one in a barbershop, and speaking to the German barber, and got introduced to this kid, and no one wanted to go to Chicago. He had this some kind of a ticket where he had to go validate it or something. So I went with him and I started meeting all these Germans for some reason. Ended up meeting three in Milwaukee, and then one invited me to come to, he lived in the Black Forest. So I came over and we toured Germany, and I came back again and again. As they were getting married, I'd come for the weddings. And next thing you know, I'm working for an American who lives in Germany and visiting. It seemed like every summer I was coming over. And I will say that first trip when I went over, it was quite fearful, but I went for it because, you know, I had this friend who I knew would be there for me and give me some structure. And I found it was quite life-changing. My whole mentality about the world, about myself, about all these things really was impacted by that first international travel. And I think that's a lot of the reason why we want to give it to our kids, right? That if they have that similar type of mind expanding experience, that it changes the way they think about things. And I think it's valuable to do, you know, in that context, things that are maybe challenging, but important for you to push yourself a little bit. So I'm so proud of you, and I think it's pretty cool what you're doing and how you're living your life. So good job.
Thank you. Well, if in doubt, say yes. That's kind of the conclusion of that. But before we took this massive detour, I wanted to say one more thing about these prompts in the book, because you said something about these prompts. Yes, they gave a structure, which was nice, like a structure on the page. And what they did as well, they actually I actually also changed my awareness of things. And during the day, you know, I would have these moments where I think like, oh, this is, you know, it could be something like something that made me smile. You know, these were tiny things. You know, I collected mostly the tiny moments because these are the moments I would forget. You know, I won't forget that I saw Angkor Wat, you know, because these are like the greatest temples, and you take thousands of pictures and you don't forget that you've seen that, right? Mm-hmm. This is a nice thing. But the tiny moments, many of them, when I look back through my books, I would not remember them if I hadn't sketch them down, you know, like, I don't know, in this place in Luang Prabang in Laos where we stayed, the toilet roll holder looked like a little hippo, you know, and I went into the bathroom and that absolutely made me smile. So that got into my book, you know, and silly little things like that I would never remember afterwards. And I can now go through the book and I can just, it's like story time, you know, if you want me to talk for hours without shutting up, just sit me down with my travel books and I just tell stories to you. Yeah.
Interesting.
But But I found it really interesting also because if after a few days, you know, we've been eating like boring stuff, I was like, oh, I haven't had anything to sketch in the eating section, you know. We haven't tried any new things. That is outrageous, you know. We need to be more adventurous. Or if I hadn't talked for people for a while, you know, new people that I didn't know, I would notice as well. I was like, well, I haven't really, you know, I have observed some people, but I haven't really talked to anybody noteworthy, you know, like haven't really mingled with people. So it was interesting to see how being like a collector of little moments also shaped my awareness of being in the experience and noticing things. And I got really excited sometimes when I learned a few new things, you know, when I learned, I don't know, there was this field that was in Cambodia. There was this, we were driving along and there was this field and there were these structures in the fields that were just like two poles. And in the middle was a plastic sheet between these two poles. And then on top there was something electrical, but I couldn't quite see what it was. And they were everywhere in the fields and we were driving along and I'm like, this is weird. These are weird things. What are they? They're everywhere. And so I drew one of them in my book for something that I had seen, you know, and hadn't quite made sense of. And then a few days later, we were doing a tour around Battambang and the tuk-tuk driver who took us around, we got chatting and I was drawing while we had lunch and he saw the book. And so he looked in it and we had a little chat and he was pointing. And then he was pointing at these things and he was like, "Hi, you noticed that?" And I'm like, "Yeah, exactly. I have got a question. What are these things?" And so he told me that they were cicada traps. So they have a little light on the top and the cicadas get attracted. They fly against this plastic sheet and then they fall in the bottom where there's a dip with water. And then they collect the cicadas because it's a delicacy and they love eating them.
Interesting.
So little stuff like that. I got really excited, you know, about seeing something that I couldn't quite figure out. And then I got even more excited when the guy explained it to me. So that was like an extra little bonus fun on the trip to kind of be this hunter of things in the environment that you don't understand or that are different from home or something.
Yeah, and I suppose away from, you know, not part of that culture, you would notice things, right, that other people maybe who are from Cambodia, like, well, of course that's a cicada trap, but, you know. And it's a little bit like being an archaeologist of the living, right? You're sort of finding out how this culture works by looking at the pieces, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. It was like on a very, I was a very surface level ethnographer, I guess, to kind of travel around the world and observe how different people do things and what they eat and what they look like and how they catch their delicacies.
Wow. That's so fascinating. And I think for anyone listening, really encouraging that if you're planning to take any kind of vacation or holiday or break or explore some new place, really encourage you to try and capture it, at very least with writing and, if possible, with drawing too. I know that it's really changed my life in the last couple of years doing logbooks in a variety of ways. And, you know, the funny thing is you mentioned these small moments. Like if I look back in the little logbook that I carry around, this little Japanese book, I've been starting to try and write the odd little things like things my kids say or funny things that happened on the way to work or, you know, what have you. And it's those things when I go back through and review the year, those are the things that are actually quite interesting to me, is all these little tidbits that I thought were throwaway, you know, things, which sounds very similar to the experience you had too, of having, you know, the little things that you think are maybe not so important. Those are the things that would easily get lost, the little details, but those are often the most interesting.
Yeah, I love details. Like, I'm a detail person anyway. I like looking at the little things.
Yep. So, well, definitely, if you're considering doing some kind of travel sketch note or, you know, maybe invent a trip so you can go try it out, that would be really fantastic. And just see how it works for you. Maybe follow this prompting concept and see if that helps you capture things. I think that's a really good practical application that you can take away from the discussion. And, you know, the bigger message is, you know, if you're afraid of something, you know, maybe go for it and see what happens. Like, it's maybe less fearful than you think it is. So So I guess let's talk a little bit more about sketchnoting particularly. I think at this point, maybe we can talk a little bit about your, maybe it's a combination of your approach and your tools. I know many people often ask, they want to know what tools people use, and that's a really fascinating topic for people. And I think probably the both of us feel like, you know, tools are, you know, just something that you use, and you can use all kinds of different tools. But of course, we end up having favorite tidbits that we like. So maybe talk a little bit about maybe first your analog things. You talked a little bit about this prompting book that you created for yourself. What are your other favorite tools that you like to use, and why do you use them as maybe an inspiration for people to try something new?
I like to use my brain and my hands and some kind of pen that is inside of my hand, like that I hold. So I think that, yeah, it's like any pen is better than no pen, you know? It's like, yeah, take any pen and just make something. And over time, while using different pens, you will find a preference, you know? Some people like thinner ones, some people like thicker ones. Everybody has their own comfort size when they sketch something. You know, when I say sketch a house, it will probably come out in a certain size. That's probably your comfort sketching size, you know? For some people, it's bigger. They prefer maybe broader pens because, you know, the proportion between line and size of drawing is the right one. Then I draw very small. I like sketching very small, and I like writing very small. So I prefer ultra thin pens when I'm doing my sketch notes. I think it's called the Pilot G-Tech C4 or something. It's a 0.3 millimeter tip. So it's very, 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 very thin. And but it's also the bad thing about this pen, it is very fragile. Like sometimes the tip would not break, but it would behave funny. It would either clog or it would bleed. And these pens don't like traveling. When you take them in an airplane, the nib goes funny. I mean, I don't know. I had these pens with me on the trip, and I used them in the sketchbook, but they are like a little princess, you know, or a little prince, you know. They want to be treated right, and if not, then they will just not behave and just be, you know, they're a little diva. So let's put it like that.
Interesting. as far as paper, it sounds like you're pretty open to whatever paper you can get your hands on. But it sounds like if you draw small, you probably maybe do like smaller books or smaller size books, or do you have like a variety of different sizes? I know when the sketch notes I've seen that maybe most people are aware of, seems like you're using a spiral book of, you know, maybe it's a square. It seems like you'd like square, at least in the past. Maybe
yeah,
that's changed.
That was, I got this at one conference, like a million ages ago, sometime in 2007. I was at a conference which was, I think it was Future of Web Design, and they had these freebie spiral notebooks that were like, I don't know, 17 by 17 inch in American, like about 20 by 20, or yeah, not as big, 20 by 20 centimeters, something like that. Okay. So they had those, and they were out there for free, and they were quite nice. They were spiral bound and had nice paper, and I thought, oh, this format is nice, and I started drawing them, and then they had them lying around. They had a goodie bag under each seat. Mm-hmm. And because at the time, I don't know, I was just starting out with my job or something. I wasn't bathing in money the way I'm doing now. Not. Yeah. But, but they were, at the end of the day, not all seats had been taken, and there were loads of these goodie bags left. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm just going to take two or three more of these sketchbooks because they are really nice. So so I had four of these sketchbooks at home, and I just started using them for the sketch notes, and I kind of liked the format. Mm-hmm. And then I ran out of those, and I asked them, where did you get them, or how did you have them made? And they gave me the name of the printer where they had them made, and I contacted them, and I asked them about the paper that they used and how they made them. And so I made my own custom sketchbooks the same size, and had made a lettering for the front and the back, and had that foil stamp. So I ordered, I don't know, I think 100 or so. You go on.
I just remember seeing you working on the cover for that, so that popped in my memory when you were working on that.
Yes, yeah, so I think I still have a box. I still have a box of. I think I still have the box somewhere with my other stuff that I haven't reunited with since our travels, with sketchbooks for life. So I can either use them up or give them to people. I don't know, but I just got used to the format, and I figured out that a normally interesting talk of 45 minutes would roughly, in the way I sketch and summarize and synthesize, would roughly give me one page in this size of sketchbook, which is good. And if the talk is a little bit less dense in information or less interesting to me, then it would be a little bit less than a page. And if it is surprisingly full of amazingness, it would be a little bit more than a page. But somehow that size felt good, and so I stuck with it.
So it was a little bit accidental, and then it turned into something very intentional, which is kind of interesting, taking those accidents and turning them into, you know, positives for sure.
That's my method. I first need to do stuff, and then I generate meaning from the doing, and I figure out if that's right or not, or if I have to adjust it. At the moment, I'm basically sketching all the time just on normal A4 paper, which is basically like your letter paper, letter sized paper, that is printer paper, just loose sheets. I just use that for drawing stuff and everything and anything, and just practicing and putting my thoughts down. I like not being precious about my material, because that can be such a holdback, you know, being precious. You feel dependent on, if I forgot this notebook at home, then I can't take my sketch notes. It's not the right format, or I don't have this pen. So I try to get as independent of the material and of thinking I need a certain setup and a certain technology or a certain equipment to do something. I just want to be free of that. I just want to go, it's not ideal, but it is what it is. And the skill comes from my head in my hand anyway.
Yeah, I think there could be a danger too, where if you require certain books or pens or certain environments, like it could be easy to fall in the trap of the writer's block, right? Where you spend all your time getting all the materials right, but you never actually produce any work. So by eliminating this blockage, right, you just use whatever's in front of you, whiteboards, napkins, paper, and, you know, 500 sheets of A4 paper are pretty cheap. It's really hard to beat that with pretty much, you know, any sketchbook, and definitely not an iPad and a pencil, right? You can buy a lot of paper for what you would spend on that, right? So, I mean, it all depends on your perspective, so... That's really interesting, and again, encouraging that, you know, people not get too hung up. I always find it interesting what people like to use, and I think it can be helpful for trying new things. But I'm also glad that there's such a variety that there's no, you know, one way that you only can do it. That just doesn't make any sense. So I'm glad that you have reinforced that with your approach to analog stuff in general. So that's really great. Now, what about digital? I think I've seen you playing around with Procreate on Instagram and probably other places. So it seems to me like you've probably got some kind of an iPad, maybe the iPad Pro and a pencil. I'm kind of curious to see what your thoughts are about the hardware and the software and how you feel about it compared to, say, good old pen and paper.
All right. So, yes, I bought an iPad and a pencil. An Apple pencil, iPencil, I don't know, the thing that you pay another 100 euros for. It's surprising how long it took technology to create something that is at the stage where for the first time it might be acceptable for doing some sketching, because up to now I thought it was just sketching on a tablet was just like not acceptable for me. It just felt wrong, and it had lag, and it's just like the tool is getting in the way all the time. And so I tried out the pencil, and it is quite nice. It is not perfect, But I think it comes to a point where the first time it's acceptable. I had Wacom tablets for a long time, and I had a Cintiq at some point at home, and that was really nice, and I liked that for kind of illustration because you sketch. I mean, like, you know, you can actually see what you're sketching because it is there where you sketch it. Wow, it's like analog, you know, it's like pen and paper. I just find it so funny that, you know, like everybody's like, wow, this pencil is amazing, you know, it's amazing how it works. And it's like, yeah, have you held like a normal pencil and a piece of paper? It's amazing how different, you know, when you tilt it, the shading that you can do, the different darknesses and stuff. Wow. I mean, I'm a bit sarcastic here, but
yeah,
it works quite well.
Yeah, I can imagine. It works quite well. It could be a funny fake TV ad where, you know, the new technology is like a pencil and a piece of paper, and you know, treating it as though it were technology, all the fantastic, you know, the gradations and the levels of grays and, you know, yeah, like something like that.
Well, one thing that is amazing when you start playing around with is like the different brush tips you can have, you know, and the different effects. And it when I tried it out, it almost feels, it definitely feels too easy. It is too easy to kind of produce all these different styles and different effects, you know, so. You know, you get it for so cheap, you know, you know, when you want to do watercolor, you don't even have to have water anymore, and you don't have to clean up the mess afterwards. You just do it very cleanly in your digital environment, you know, or when you acrylic and oil paint, you know, it's like you don't have the smell and the stains on the fingers and the, yeah, and the turpentine and the stuff that you have to clean it and stuff. It's just all, it just all gets very easy, which I find a bit, I don't know how I feel about it, but I definitely found like it felt like cheating, you know, trying all these things out. And it's like, this is too easy. It should come with a little bit of effort and grit. The other thing that happens is that because it is so easy, it is very, very easy to get kind of, to throw everything around and to get, you know, like, oh yeah, maybe a little bit of watercolor here and a bit of this here and some sprinkle and sparkle and schnick schnack and stuff, you know. It's like, because I think it's like when you first use Photoshop, you know, and you have all these filters, you produce awful work because there's no restraint and it's all like, oh wow, look at this, poo, fireworks and motion blur and stuff. So the important thing for me when trying to do anything useful with this was just setting myself boundaries and using restraint and choosing what I want to use, and then stick to these one or two different different brush tips and one of two different things that I want to try out and see how much I can get out of it. So all the overwhelming possibilities that the device gives me, I want to restrain and like pull it back just to a couple of choices and work with them for a while and see what I can do with them, and then maybe move on and work with another setting and see what that can do before I just start switching between everything all the time.
I think that's a great approach, and I sort of stumbled into that same vortex, I guess you might say, when I first started out.
Yeah, I've been doing sketch notes at one event with the iPad. I went to a type design conference here in Berlin, and so I thought, well, I'll take the iPad Pro and I just see what happens. Like when I try doing sketchnoting, you know, it's like, it doesn't have to be complete, doesn't have to be great. If it's absolutely shit, I just want to get used to it. So, there were a few things that I had observed in other people's digital notes that also had like that I had noticed that I thought like, oh, these are some problems that I want to avoid, and these are things that I don't want to happen. So I didn't want the notes to have the typical sketch notes done on iPad look, which is this, it is hard to describe, but it is this really clean, rounded, stroke of the pen that also doesn't have quite defined corners, you know, not quite cornery corners, but slightly rounded, maybe because there's some lag, or maybe, you know, the whole thing is just more slippery, so you don't do the proper corners, you know, everything just gets a little bit more rounded just by the gesture. So I didn't want that because that always feels like just it is this weird rounded soft wash digital thing that didn't happen on purpose, but just weirdly from the tool, I felt. Another problem I had observed in some is that one of the biggest problems is probably to keep the scale, because you can zoom in and zoom out. It is super easy to kind of lose the overview and lose the scale and sketch stuff that is massive or really tiny, you know, and because you don't see it all at the same time. And in some application, it also seems that the width of the pen is not linked to the zoom level. So it means if you zoom right in, the width of the pen is the same compared to the screen. So if you sketch anything at a big zoom level, it is much fatter than if you sketch anything when it's right zoomed out. And so you end up, or people are resizing stuff, so you end up with different stroke widths, and you can see that, yeah, this has been digitally shrunk or digitally zoomed in or sized. And I find that aesthetically very unpleasing, and I don't aesthetically unpleasing, but also it messes with the visual hierarchy of stuff, because the thinner stuff just looks weaker and the proportion looks wrong, and it just distracts from the message and distracts the viewer. So I wanted to avoid that. That was definitely a challenge, because I also have only the small iPad. I didn't buy the big one.
Yeah, me too.
I wanted the whole thing. And I also didn't want to get drawn into the fact that I can erase everything and I can move everything around, like a balance between creating and editing, and having both options available to me. First and foremost, just having editing available, but then also having editing available while I am creating and listening. I didn't want the editing to play a major part and take over. It was interesting to see, you know, to play around with it and to balance it, but I think the danger is that you get into editing mode before you haven't really created anything, you know, which is in general the problem about the creative process. It's like, you know, the inner judge, the inner editor, edit, ah, this is not good, put it here, put it there. And by mixing the two, by mixing the creating and the editing, I think you're just cutting yourself off. You're cutting yourself short, and it probably limits you from what you can do rather than help you.
Yeah, those things that you've identified are all things that I've observed as well, and quite intentionally have kept me focused on one application when I do the work. I try to work at 100% for the most part, put limits on how much I move things around or change things, because unlike paper, like once you put the pen on the paper, I mean, that's where the line's going, right? You have to commit a little bit more, and it's in the friction that's there that forces it to, in some ways, be a little bit exciting. You kind of lose that with the digital, because you can just change it, right? You can delete it, you can change it, you can move it around. If you didn't quite get it right, you can zoom in and fix it. So all the benefits, in some ways, can somehow give you too many outs or too many options. And like you say, you get way too worried about editing things before you've actually got anything finished enough to know if maybe the thing you were doing was okay and it didn't need editing at all, right?
Yeah. Also, I mean, another interesting thing that happened for me is, like, when we're talking about the editing, there was something that happened as well, is when I do things on paper, it's absolutely clear the decision that I make about the placement or about what I write or what I sketch in the moment is from my best knowledge and ability, from what I know and have heard until that moment in time in the talk, you know. And sometimes things are placed more luckily and make more sense or are more coherent when you look at the whole afterwards. Sometimes some things are just somewhere, and then you have the pleasure of kind of trying to make sense of the things and connect them in other ways. But I have to commit to a placement and without the full knowledge of the whole talk that I have with hindsight. And this is one of the biggest challenges that people bring to me when they want to learn sketchnoting. They're like, how do I make a structure? Where do I place things? And mm-hmm. the thing is like, there's no magic bullet for it. You try to place it the best way you think where it could or should belong at the moment when the person says it. And then you live with it, and then you deal, and then you place all the other stuff around it. It's like, you know, it's, you get a feeling for it, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
But with the editing, you know, you can move things around. So I also felt that there was a little bit more of an obligation, because I could move things, to have a little bit more of a logical structure. And I used, I noticed when I look back at the videos that I made, it is also interesting to kind of just observe yourself constructing this thing. Like look back at it and think like, this is the order in which I did it. And this is, this is how I approach it. But so I used that mainly like, in the last third of the talk, you know, when like you, the last third of the information is coming in and you already have, you get this, you start to have this holistic view of this talk, you know, like, this was the problem the person was laying out and these were some of the things she was thinking about and here's some solution and she has a conclusion and things like that, that I started to move things around a little bit more radically. And because I felt there's an obligation because I can do some edits in moving, there's also the obligation to have a little bit more of a sound structure in the end than what I would have when I just do it in real time on paper, where it's just like, yeah, well, tough luck. This is my best try, and this is how it is. Mm-hmm. And on the iPad, it's like, okay, I spend another 2 minutes rearranging it and maybe putting some labels in, and then it's like, yeah, this is just so much better because hindsight is a beautiful thing. You know, you see a structure that emerges at the end of it. So also a little bit of an obligation to kind of organize things in a little bit more of a coherent way just because it's possible.
So it's almost like because you can, you should, which the word that popped in my mind as you're talking about all this is a little bit of a loss of serendipity. So like having a pen and paper where you put things down, you know, if that thing goes there, it's ink on paper, you're not moving it. Like that's the serendipity of the moment. Now it sort of forces you to think in a different way that you can move around it, right?
I think I would. I have the same thoughts when I actually work on paper, but I just can't act on them. You know, I can't act on them in the same way unless. And I have sometimes done it when I used sketch notes later to present back a talk to people in the team. I will take the sketch note in Photoshop. I will chop it apart and rearrange the parts to kind of form the story and structure the story in a way that I would tell it, you know, like, but that was an extra step that didn't happen on the paper, and I can't rearrange stuff on physically on a paper. So I think it's not like it forces me to have thoughts or structure that I didn't have before. It is just now I can do it, and I probably should, because it also helps me in my process to kind of like just express the structure that I understood at the end of the talk and just manifest it in my sketch as well. And yes, you lose a little bit of the serendipity. You don't have to lose it, because you can still just not edit at all while you're sketching and then do the editing afterwards, or just say, well, I don't feel the obligation, so screw it, I won't do it. What I think is maybe a little bit sad is just the, not sad, but I love the challenge on paper, and that I have to commit to something that I don't know what's coming next, you know, and because the feeling when it really works out well is amazing, you know, it feels 10,000 times more like a win than when you, you know, rearranged it and you can edit it. It is the difference between a rehearsed theater play and improvisation, you know?
Yep.
When you do a great improvisation and, you know, you haven't prepared, well, you have practiced before, but you didn't know before what you were going to do. You went there just with, you know, with yourself and showed up and did something and it worked out great. It is a great feeling. And with a rehearsed play, it's a great feeling as well, but in a different way, I would say. Hmm. And that's kind of maybe the subtle difference between, you know, the two.
maybe the way to preserve the feeling of the paper is maybe you limit yourself from editing until, like you say, after the talk's over or near the end of the talk, right? So that's maybe a way to put that constraint on yourself.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, you can give yourself limits all the, I mean, you can, the best, one of the most inspiring things and best things for producing better work is give yourself limits.
Oh yeah, definitely. Most definitely. I think it's interesting too that, so I've been really focusing on one application, even though I know there's many. I've chosen Paper by 53 in a lot of ways because it's got those limitations built in. Like there's only one pen size for these different things and it's pixels. So once you put it down, you can move it around, but you can't like in some apps, if it's vector based, you can like change the type of brush, you can change the color, and which is great.
That is horrible.
Yeah. I mean, so, and again, I would divide and say that maybe for sketchnoting, it's not as ideal, but maybe for illustration, it's awesome, right? The ability to kind of mess around with thicknesses and strokes and colors, that's maybe more optimized for that type of application. But
but imagine you would never use Illustrator to sketchnote. I mean, you know, for graphic design and for logos and stuff, but that hasn't crossed my mind.
So I really like that Paper has these, it puts these limits on me, and sometimes they're a little bit frustrating, but they force me to think in different ways. So as an example, in Paper, you can copy something and duplicate it, but you can't copy it between canvases. So if I want to put it on another place, I can't do that. And there's some limitations, you know, the tools are limited. And I kind of like that. Like it's been forcing me to find different ways to work within that structure. And until I feel like I'm getting more mastery on the tool itself, then maybe I'll explore another tool. Like Procreate's definitely the next one on the list because of some of the features. But like you know, the way I approach everything, I would probably limit myself to a couple of brushes and not go crazy because I would just get bogged down in the decision making or fooling around too much instead of focusing on doing the work. So I'm definitely a big believer in limitations or constraints to focus myself, because I know otherwise I'll just go crazy.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, you have this Saturday afternoon when it's raining out there and you go like, okay, I'm going to go out with appropriate brushes, you know, and I'm going to do all the silly stuff, you know, and then after 2 hours you have it out of your system and then you can do the serious work.
Exactly. So I think this is a great time at this point. I think there's probably lots of tips that have come through the discussion we've had to maybe talk about three different things that you might recommend someone who's, let's say, newer to sketchnoting, someone who's stumbled on our conversation, is inspired by some things, and wants to really dive into it and take it even more seriously or give it a try. What are maybe three tips that you might recommend to somebody in that position?
I would recommend the next pen that you see either in front of you, lying on your desk, or anywhere where you come past, take it and use it and sketch something that you can see in your surrounding. That is the first step. Whenever you see a pen, use it. The next thing is, I think practicing. I'm a big believer in regular practice. Like I'm also a believer in you can learn anything you like. It maybe depends a bit to which degree you will get good at it. You know, if you might not get amazing at it, you might just get all right at it. But you can learn anything, and sketching is the same. So, but you have to do it in order to get better. And what I like people, what I tell people, and what I do myself, when you see what I'm doing on Instagram, I sometimes post these sheets. I draw things over and over again. I try to figure out how to sketch something. That can be from objects around me. I don't know, at the moment I see an apple juice carton on my desk and it has an interesting shape. It is like a milk carton, you know, like this square thing with with a thing at the top. I would take that and I would try to figure out how to sketch that in the simplest way possible, you know, reducing it to simple shapes. And then I would sketch it. I would take an A4 paper and I'll just sketch it over and over again, the whole sheet full. And I will learn something about, you know, the right proportions, because I'll figure it out over time. It will tell me something about in which order to sketch things, because sometimes it is easier to start with one part and then the other. And I would try different things out, and I would come to a conclusion of, oh, this is my way of sketching this this juice carton. Mm-hmm. So do it over and over again. Like, just have fun getting into the rhythm of sketching one thing over and over. And then third, enjoy well, get used to the fact that you will produce things that you don't like. That is totally normal. That happens all the time. That happens to everybody. I regularly produce a lot of things that I don't like, and I go and it doesn't matter. Producing things that you don't like is a step to producing the things that you like. You have to produce a lot of stuff that you're not happy with for the few things that you're happy with. It's a normal process. Mm-hmm. And we tend to forget that, because the stuff that we get to see is the thing that are the things that made the selection, you know? Yeah. These are the things that live to see the light of day. These are the things that get posted on social media, or that get used in the in projects and end up in portfolios. And of course, these are the things that people deemed good. And we don't see all the other stuff that they produce that they don't like, but it's totally normal. And keep producing things you don't like. Mm-hmm. And don't be frustrated about it.
Yeah, it's almost critical to the process to, like you say, to get to the thing you like. You almost have to go through the path of doing lots of things you don't like to get there, right?
Exactly. It's more normal to produce things that you're not happy with than produce things that you're happy with. At least it's like that for me. I mean, I have a big output, and most of my output, I'm not jumping for joy, you know. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, that's all right, that does the job, but it's not great, and sometimes it's really bad.
I guess, but think about it, you know, from the other perspective, if everything you did was perfect the first time, how boring would that be, right? It wouldn't be that exciting, because you wouldn't have had the opportunity to maybe achieve it through process, I think.
Yeah, I mean, for one day, that would be great. I mean, give me one day where everything is perfect that I make, that would be amazing.
But after about, you know, the 50th day of everything being perfect and amazing, like, it would get a little bit boring. It's like the Matrix, like people living in the Matrix. They had to add, I think if I remember right from the film, they had to add like problems into the programming, because people were like, you know, couldn't handle it. It was freaking them out because everything was too perfect, right? So we sort of as humans need this the challenge and the achievement of process in our lives to feel, you know, to feel the joy of actually achieving, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's part of being human, you know. That's part of being human and not being a computer.
Yes, exactly.
And it's important. And it's important. It is even more important as, you know, artificial intelligence is starting to make, artificial intelligence and computers are starting to make art. You know, it's like they're painting, like, you know, what are these filters called that everybody posted recently from the iPhone, the Prisma thing or something?
Oh,
Prisma,
I know.
Filters.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean.
Interesting. I haven't heard that one.
I think it's called Prisma. It's like, it's basically, you can apply it to a photo and it does different painting styles.
Okay.
You know, we still know that from the 90s or 2000s, where it was basically really bad. Mm-hmm. You know, it looked like really bad filters, but it's getting to a point where it looks like, you know, like Russian constructionist painting, or like it is getting really good. You know, the computer is getting really skilled at making paintings in a certain style. Mm-hmm. And at some point, as a human, you ask yourself, yeah, well, if a computer can do that, they're great. Why should I even bother doing it? And the thing is, not because the product, at some point, the computer's product, computers might produce better art than humans do, but the important thing is that it it is something that makes us fundamentally human. It is having agency and being able to express yourself. And even if the product is not perfect, it helps you as a human be who you are and express who you are and go through a process of developing your personality. And I think that's why it is important to keep creating as well.
Yeah. And I have the sense that the imperfect art is actually more interesting than the perfect one, right? In many ways. So,
yeah, that as well.
Yeah. I think that's what I find most enjoyable is the little quirks. And I think, at some point, you know, artificial intelligence will maybe weed out all the quirks so you have a perfect piece of art, but it won't really move your soul, right? It'll just be a perfect rendition of that style, which, you know, maybe there's a point where it can do that. I don't know. That's really good.
At some point, it will have algorithms built in that actually emulate the little quirks, you know? There will be singularity at some point. Oh, my God. A brave new world.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for making time for us, Ivalada. And I think what I'd like to do is have you offer places where people can interact with you. I know you're on Instagram and Twitter, and you've got a website. So why don't you go through the different places where people can see your work and reach out to you and have a chat if they'd like.
Okay. Well, let's see. On basically all social media, like Twitter, Instagram, Flickr for people who still use that. I always have the same handle, and it is at Ivalotchen, which is German for little Ivalotta. So I'm going to spell it because it's weird to non-German speakers. It's Ivalotchen. So you will find me. I have a website for the sketchnoting books that I made, which is called sketchnotesbook.com. Mm-hmm. And for the travel sketchnotes, actually what I'm doing is if people want to relive my trip, I made a website which is called secretsfromtheroad.com. Mm-hmm. And on the 25th of September, 2 years ago, we started traveling, and I'm actually this website is going to relive our trip, and I will post like the spread of each day, like in real time, 2 years after the fact. So I'm going to start on the 25th of September, and then you can take the trip with me, like, cool, in a two-year time lag. So we'll start in India on the 25th of September and then keep traveling east until we're back in Europe 14 months later.
So every day you'll have something new to see and learn and enjoy. So that's a really cool way to do it. Yeah.
At the exact same pace that we traveled on our trip.
Wow, that's really fantastic. That's really, and of course, I will gather up all these links for you guys so you can go in the show notes and click away and see those things, subscribe to those things, say hello to Ivalada, and thank her for the time that she spent sharing her wisdom and having fun having a chat. So thanks, Ivalada, so much for making the time and being with us.
Thank you for having me, and I hope I didn't ramble too much.
Oh, it was wonderful. That was what I was hoping for. I think it's a wonderful ramble. Again, part of the process.
Great.
So thanks for making it so much fun, and we will wrap our Sketchnote Army podcast with that. So until next episode, we'll talk to you later.